Evening, everybody. Pleasure to have you with us tonight and see all your smiling faces, and appreciate very much you being out tonight. Our beloved Gil said that that cold finally caught up to him, and that NyQuil seems to be putting it at rest, so we hope that will take care of it. I've often thought that that was the only legal alcohol a Christian could drink, because that's mostly 90% alcohol. Yeah, medicinal. Thank you, John. But it does work. I've used it in the past myself. So yes, we're grateful that you're here. We're going to be mindful of Gil, and I'm not sure if you noticed, but Nadine is not with us tonight. I understand she had a fall and is dealing with that and some of the issues that go along. And I'm sure maybe Karen. I saw Karen Bremseth here, so perhaps she'll have an update for us. I thought I would talk out of the other side of my mouth tonight, and that's why I put the microphone on this side. Normally, it's on that side, so I thought I'd try something different, but I am now running into a little bit of difficulty with my collar, so I think I may wind up taking this thing off. If you haven't been with us for a while, hang on a second. So if you have not been with us for a while, we are studying in the book of Luke, and we are on John, thank you. And we are on chapter 6. And before we get started, I think it's important for us to understand, does everybody have an idea of what context means when it comes to the scriptures? It's very important for us to be able to understand context, because for us to be able to grasp what Jesus is talking about, and in this particular opening here, it's important for us to know really what's going on, who are they talking to, what's the time frame, what's happening in that time frame, for us to really get the import of where we're going to start on this class tonight. And we're just going to take a quick review of something, because I want to build up a little more context about this idea of Jesus feeding the 5,000. And I know you had studied that prior. We had a song class last week, so I'd like to refresh your memory just a little bit if we can. But before we get even in that vein of reading that, Charles, would you mind leading us in an opening prayer? Amen. Thank you very much. Oh, anybody need a lesson study sheet at all? There's one right there. There's a taker. Let me just catch you up on something else that came through. Rosie has a cold, and this is for the Dickies. Rosie's working on a cold, and Jody says mom has a sore throat, so please keep them in our prayers. By the way, you probably all have Gil's cell phone number, but you may not have mine. 559-917-3246. 559-917-3246. And I'll try to pay attention if you have any comments that you would like to make regarding the class. So we're going to be finding our opening in chapter 6 of the book of John. So if you'll turn over there, if you don't mind, I'm going to ask some of you to read, and I would appreciate it very much if you'd like to do that. If you don't want to do that, just say so, and we'll figure it out one way or another. So John chapter 6, and I believe that starts in, let's see, is it verse... What verse is that starting in? Forgive me. Let's see. Okay, so let's go back to, let's start at verse 1. So if somebody, I know it's a lengthy reading, but if you wouldn't mind, go ahead and read all the way down to verse 13, if you would. 1 through 13, chapter 6, 1 through 13. Go ahead.
It says, after this, Jesus went away to the other side of the Sea of Galilee, which is the Sea of Tiberias, and a large crowd was following him because they saw the signs that he was doing on the sea. Jesus went up on a mountain, and there he sat down with his disciples. Now to pass over the feast, was at hand. Lifting up his eyes, then, and seeing that the large crowd was coming toward him, Jesus said to Philip, where are we to buy bread so that these people may eat? He said this to test him, for he himself knew what he was going to do. Philip answered him, 200 denarii worth of bread would not be enough for each of them to get a little. One of his disciples, Andrew, Simon Peter's brother, said to him, there is a boy here who has 5 barley loaves and 2 fish, but what are they for so many? Jesus said, have the people sit down. Now there was much grass in this place. So the men sat down, about 5,000 in number. Jesus then took the loaves, and when he had given thanks, he distributed them to those who were seated. So also the fish, as many as they wanted. And when they had eaten their fill, he told his disciples, gather up the leftover fragments, that nothing may be lost. So they gathered them up and lifted, or filled 12 baskets with fragments from the 5 barley loaves left by those who have eaten.
Excellent. Thank you, Brother Bailey. I appreciate that. So context is important. So let's see if we can mine a little bit more understanding out of this so we can really get a grasp of what's happening in here before we begin to answer some of the questions that were left off last time. So the context is, how large a crowd was there? 5,000. How is it that 5,000 people just show up? How is that? You have to put flyers and banners and all kinds of stuff to get 5,000 people to go to the Save Mart Center. But how is it that 5,000 people just show up at Jesus' gathering? Here's the context. Go ahead, John. Okay.
And they knew that he performed miracles. And I think he would make that comment to them at some point in his discourse, like, yeah, you guys are following me because he fed, there was another incident where he fed a lot of people in the similar circumstances. And so he's saying, you know, you guys are here because you've seen me perform miracles and do signs and wonders. Not necessarily because you care about salvation or you care about learning more about me, but you know what I've done.
Yeah, so they have some idea, Charles.
You've seen churches around the town that have a marquee and say, free food on Saturday.
Yeah, you're way ahead of me. We're going to get there real soon. Here's why context, I'll get you a second, Brother Bailey. What event's going to be happening here in Jerusalem real quick? The Passover is coming. Now, the Fresno does something that is unique in the entire United States. We host, or Fresno hosts, the Hmong celebration. That is the only place in the country that does that. So if I'm a Hmong and I want to celebrate that celebration, where do I have to be if I want to do that? I have to be in Fresno. And even more exclusively, I have to be at the fairgrounds to make that all happen, for me to be a part of it. Was there a commandment that the Jews needed to be in Jerusalem for Passover? Absolutely. So would it be hard for Jesus to get a big crowd around him? Probably not. Probably. And I don't know if you guys ever seen the old story, follow the leader, right? So you see like a couple hundred people going that way. Everybody goes, what's going on? What's going on? What's going on? So we know that the Passover is about to happen. I would surmise that there had to be more than 5,000 people in Jerusalem gathering at that time. But it's some of the other Gospels allude to the fact that this is a certain sect of people that are working their way to the Passover and kind of run across this thing with Jesus. Okay, so we've got 5,000 people there. Jesus turns to Philip and he says, hey, how are we going to feed them? And Andrew says, here's a boy. And what does this young man have? He has how many loaves? Five. And how many fishes? Two fishes. Again, context is huge. If you came to the Passover, more than likely, it wasn't like you could go there and then go back home and come back, right? So you had to be able to have some supplies to sustain you. And here's a young boy that has these supplies that's coming along with him. But here's the fascinating thing to note. What kind of bread is it? It's barley. Now, barley rates real low on my scale of bread. I think it goes like sourdough, rye, you know, just kind of ticks down there. So barley was something that was used for people of a status. Was it used for rich people? No, they had fine ground corn or wheat. Barley was a substance that was typically given to what? The animals. Yeah, barley was something that was given to the animals. And I think now we've probably figured out that it's part of a beer recipe now in these later days. Because it seemed like it was a product. But what I find fascinating about this, that this young man is gathered with these other people, are these people that are gathered around Jesus really rich? What would you surmise? Probably not. If this young boy's got these barley loaves, because Jesus starts breaking these loaves, right, and handing them fish. Now, the only fish that I think I eat on purpose is that you break it up and is anchovies, because my wife likes to put it in a salad. But if somebody started handing me a barley loaf and a smelt, which I've caught many of them, but they hand me that, I'd look at it and go, I don't eat this kind of stuff. But what's fascinating here is that all of these people ate, and there was a huge collection. Now, did they just get a small portion, like when you go to McDonald's and you get a child's meal, you just get a one portion? What do we know about the context of this thing? That they ate and ate and ate until they were full. They let them just continue to go after this. Now, I find that fascinating because these folks either had to be really hungry or they were going to sustain themselves to the next meal. And we're going to find out, and that Charles had brought that up. We're going to talk about this next meal. Another interesting question. Do we know the age of this young boy? The scripture does not actually say that, but what are some of the things that we can surmise about the age of this young man? How old was Jesus when he left his parents and went and talked with the Pharisees and the Sadducees and the scribes? He was 12 years old, exactly right. We find that in Luke chapter 2, 41 through 42. It would seem to me that this child or this young boy perhaps was on his own, perhaps was fulfilling his mission of being at the Passover, or perhaps was the only one of his family who could do that. But it just seems to me that this young boy isn't going along with the crowd. He's there for a certain reason. Okay, here's an interesting thing. Where did Jesus command these people to sit down? He did, but he told them in a specific place to sit down. What does the Testament say? This is all about context, guys. All about that. Does it say grass? Much grass. He told them, okay, somebody please turn your Bible to Psalms 32, 1 through 2 and read that for me. Psalms 32, verses 1 and 2. Aaron, it's good to see you. I hope you're feeling better. Anybody got it? Psalms 32, 1 and 2. I'm going to pull a Gil. We should know that one by heart. What is it? The Lord is my shepherd. I shall not want. Oh, what did I say? 32? So if I ever quote you a scripture, just know that it could be verse 3. I saw all you guys scanning. What is he talking about? Exactly. So the Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. Why shall I not want? He maketh me what? To lie down in green pastures. I think that's fascinating because Jesus makes them do that and they do it. Again, here it's context. But they're going to be realizing something about Jesus very quickly. Now, one of the things we also noted, too, is that all of this is done in an orderly fashion, isn't it? The disciples get everybody to sit down. Jesus begins to break the bread. Who serves the food? All of the disciples, they begin to get all that food out to him. By the way, are we just talking about 12 disciples, or could there be a whole lot more? Aaron's saying there's a whole lot more. And we'll find out about that whole lot more here real soon. Okay, so there was no fighting, no disruptions. Nobody said, why are you feeding table number 12 before you're feeding table number 1? I don't know if you've ever been in a buffet situation like that, but it's always frustrating if you're table number 1 and table 12 gets their food first. Drives me crazy. Okay, we already discovered that it is not a small portion of bread or meat that's given out to them. So I want you to make this comparison. How does this compare to the wilderness feedings? It was served to them, and they didn't have to go get it. But in the wilderness feedings, they got everything they could pick up, couldn't they? They got everything they could eat. They got everything that would sustain them for that day. But what was the one thing that they had to do before the Sabbath? They were required to do something. Well, before the Sabbath, they couldn't collect on the Sabbath, so what did they have to do the day before? They had to get a double portion, didn't they? So here's what's fascinating about this. These folks ate and ate and ate. They didn't need to have a double portion in this case, but they were fed, and they were fed in, quote, the wilderness, if you think about it. But the beautiful thing here is that this compares that Moses and his relationship to the people and feeding them, and now Jesus and his relationship to the feeding them. These people contextually are beginning to grab all this and put it in their head, and they go, who? This makes sense. This makes sense. Or what we say nowadays is the pieces of the puzzle are starting to come together. Aaron? Yeah, and we're going to see that later on in this chapter about this idea about Jesus being the bread of life. But the last thing I would like to make and put into your mind as to context is they're there in preparation of the Passover. What do you think is on their mind? Tough question because we're not Jews, right? But what we know from the context, John. Yeah, I think you're right. I would think that the majority of them, I hope, John, would be of that persuasion. But how do we know throughout the years people hadn't adulterated this type of a feast thing? We already know that the priests have done it. We already know that the priests were taking in lame animals and sacrificing them. We know that Jesus went into the temple and they had totally messed that up. So they're here at Passover. Now, something very interesting happens at Passover that doesn't happen any other time in Jerusalem, and it's overrun with Jews. And at that point of time, do you think there might have been more Jews in Jerusalem than there were Roman soldiers? Yeah. Scary time for the Romans, I would imagine, wouldn't it be? Right.
A lot of Jews were killed every year at Passover in Jerusalem because of the insurrections and things of that nature. So,
That's exactly right. And to the Jews, what was the biggest ire about having Romans in Jerusalem? Being ruled by that? What was one of their biggest pet peeves? Probably a bunch of them, but. What would you say? That's true. They didn't have their own king. But it boiled down to this. Taxation. God had given them that land. Why are they paying a tax to a Romans to be in a land that's theirs? That just threw them off. And that was one of the questions that Jesus was asked, right? To whom should we pay tribute to? And Jesus says, well, who's on the coin? Give to Caesar the things that are Caesar's and give to God the things that are God. So we have this collectivity of people that they're all coming together. And I would imagine that the temperature, if you were to say that, of the of a possible uprising is pretty huge. So we see all of this is happening. So we've got Passover. We've got them looking at Jesus, being able to do these miracles. But now, they actually saw Jesus breaking this bread and breaking the fish and giving it out. They couldn't figure out who's running through the jack-in-the-box and keeps getting resupplied. Nobody's moving. They're just this all this. So they're observing all of this. Now, I say that to say this. Do you think the Jews knew their Old Testament? I think they did, Aaron. I think they knew it very, very well. And I'm going to prove that point here in a few minutes. Okay. Somebody read 14 and 15 of the opening in John chapter 6. So this is after the whole multitude's been filled. They've picked up the baskets, and now this is what happens.
Therefore, when the people saw the sign she had performed, they said, this is truly the prophet who is coming to the world. So Jesus, perceiving that they were intending to come and take him by force to make him king, withdrew again.
Excellent reading. So what do they surmise about Jesus? Is he a prophet? The prophet. They have been waiting for this person to show up. Would somebody please read Deuteronomy 18, verse 15? That's why I'm going to tell you that these Jews knew their Talmud, or they knew the Old Testament. So Deuteronomy, I'll read it. 18, verse 15 says, the Lord thy God shall raise up unto thee a prophet from the midst of thee, of thy brethren, like unto thee, and ye shall hearken unto him. They knew it. They saw something in Jesus that just checked all the boxes. I know when I sell real estate sometimes, we'll go through a house and I'll have had a pre-interview with my clients and I'll say, hey, this checks all the boxes. Let's buy it. And they'll find they have a new box that I didn't know about, and so we have to uncheck that house. But the fascinating thing is, these guys knew their Old Testament. So they look at him and they say, okay, hey, Jesus, this is the guy. But now with all this pent up, I'm going to call it anger or anticipation of the Passover coming, what do they try to do in verse 15? What is it they try to do? Take him by force and make him the king. So I have to ask you this question. Why would they want to change governments? The Romans are actually going to do them a favor if you think about it, right? Down the road, who allows Jesus to be crucified? It's the Roman government, right? So why would they want to change governments when all of a sudden that they've got somebody who's going to do them a favor? Or was there an underlying distaste for the Romans? There was absolutely an underlying distaste for the Romans. Yeah, it wasn't underlying. I'm sure it was well felt. I would have hated to have been a centurion at that time. It would have been interesting. Let me look back at my notes. I'm sorry, I'm umming so much. That's it. Exactly. And I'm going to go back to verse 14 for just a quick second here, is that they saw the signs. How many of us used to, when I was in sales down in Southern California, you really had to pay attention to signs because you could get lost so quickly. Back in Southern California, the roads are so massive. And I imagine your UPS guys were using Thomas Guide book maps. Were you using them here at one time? Well, now everything, you don't have to pay attention to the sign because it tells you where to turn and do all that kind of. But they're just seeing all this stuff, and they're paying attention to this, and all of a sudden, oh, yeah, we got this. Ask the question, do you think they were caught up in the moment about just saying, let's make Jesus a king, or were their passions overheated, do you think? John?
What indication did they ever get that Jesus never wanted to be their king?
Very good. Yeah. Well, if you saw something that you've never seen before that you think is powerful, more powerful than the Roman government, wouldn't you want that person on your team? Absolutely you would. And so they try to grab Jesus and want to make him an earthly king, and it's not going to happen. And what I think is fascinating here is these 5,000 men were willing to do what? They were willing to risk limb and life to make this happen. Just 5,000 of them were going to try this, because that's all we know that is in this conclave, so to speak, this gathering of all these people. So there's 5,000 people that, let's go do it, Charles. 5,000 men. Yes, thank you for the clarity. Yeah, so they could have had more, but their passions are getting at them. They're really going. And then what is the reaction of Jesus? What does he do? He certainly isn't the cheerleader in front of it. He left. Yeah, he departs, and he leaves, and he goes away. So these questions that came to my mind while I was studying this. So it says he departed again to the mountains by himself. I have three or four questions. So why did Jesus not go along with the plans of the people? Aaron? Exactly.
I think at that moment in time, Judas realizes this is not the earthly king that I thought we were looking for.
Yep.
This is not the Jesus that I'm looking for. Hence, the betrayal happens right after. I think this is that was a really key moment. But yet, we find in Acts, everybody's wondering.
I know. That's got to be frustrating. Yeah, there will always be some that get it and don't. I'm going to give you my five reasons. Four reasons. A, it wasn't his time. As you had said, Aaron alluded to, do you think if he'd have done that, that a lot of people would have been killed? The Romans would not have stood by for that. They would just not let that happen. It did not fit in God's plan, did it? Do you know what the number one reason is? If Jesus had done that, he would have sinned. He would not have been the perfect sacrifice. And I'm going to prove that point. So Luke chapter 4, verse 5, we find this, the temptation of Jesus. And in Luke 4, verse 5, it says, "And the devil, taking him up to a high mountain, showed unto him all the kingdoms of the world in a moment of time. And the devil said to him, all this power I will give thee, and the glory of them, for that is delivered unto me, and to whomever I give it to. If thou therefore wilt worship me, all shall be thine." And in verse 8, Jesus answered and said unto him, "Get thee behind me, Satan, for it is written, thou shalt worship the Lord thy God, and him only shalt thou serve." Jesus had to maintain his perfect, sinless life. Aaron?
Mm-hmm. He says, "You're the Christ." And Jesus said, "That's not from you."
That's right.
That's wisdom from the high places in James, right? Those are the high places the wisdom came from. The very next thing that came out of Peter's mouth was, "I will not allow you to be killed."
Yep.
"I will control the events." And so, literally, Peter takes a breath, says the next thing, and one thing came.
Yeah, I hadn't made the correlation with that. I just want to stress something here. Does Satan ever give up on you, John? Satan never gives up. Because what we know is this has happened after Jesus had been through his wilderness time, his 40 days in the wilderness. This temptation now is happening. And that's, I want to illustrate this for Christians. Sometimes we can get caught up in the moment, folks. And when we get caught up in the moment and there is this frenzy going on, that we can just be trapped. And all of a sudden we go, "What did I just do? I cannot believe I did that." And here's all these people saying, "Rah, rah, rah, sis, boom, bah, Jesus, we want you to be our king. Come on." Wouldn't that be exciting? Wouldn't that be amazing? For a human being, that's crazy. So I think about political rallies. They get 200,000-300,000 people out there and all, everybody's rah, 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 rah. And it is just going along with the crowd sometimes, and it is so dangerous. But Jesus knew that, and he withdrew himself from that. And I think there's an example there for all of us. When we find ourselves caught up in the moment, what do we need to do? Step back, withdraw ourselves from that. So all of these things are happening in this time of Passover. I can't even begin to imagine what the dinner table conversations are all about. You think about the two men that were walking on the road to Emmaus, how in their conversation they were talking about everything that had happened in Jerusalem, about Jesus and all the things that had happened and all that excitement and everything going on. Can you imagine all of these people there for one reason, to serve God? And hopefully that was their intent of their heart. But now to run into something that is bigger and greater than anything. And for those pure of heart, they were actually looking for Jesus to come. They were looking for a Messiah. So I'm going to ask you a question. Are you looking for Jesus to come again? We should all be looking for that. Jesus is going to come again. And the beautiful thing about this is, we'll know it. We'll recognize it. He'll be a part of our lives. It won't take us by surprise. There won't be there won't be a big rally. We'll be all caught up in the air, and we'll be with him forever. Go ahead, Aaron. Correct.
That's what the all of what we're talking about is the physical to the spiritual being. No concept.
So when we talk about the type and the antitype, they weren't able to put those two together. They couldn't figure it out. They knew they were looking for something, but they couldn't put it all together. All right, so now we're going to move on to the next segment, beginning, I believe, starting at chapter, they get in the boat. Where did you read down to? 14, 15? Someone read 16 through 20, 16 through 31, if you would. No, I'm sorry, 16 through 21. Yeah, please. Anybody? 16 through 21? Excellent reading. Thank you. Okay, so the disciples go down, and all by themselves, they decide to get in this boat and row across the sea. Is that true? Did the disciples rarely do anything without Jesus telling them to do something? So if we were to look this up in the book of Mark, chapter 6, 45, it says that he went down to the sea and they got in a boat. Jesus was with them and told them to get in that boat and go. And then he went up into the mountain that we can surmise. But one of the things is, what time of day is this, Aaron? It's dark. Now, what time does it get dark now? 5 o'clock. So this is, I think, the third hour of the day, which I think is like 6 p.m. And so it's 6 p.m. at night. We don't know what seasonality this is, whether it's daylight saving times or not daylight saving times, but these guys get in a boat at night and they take off. Has anybody ever done that? I did it one time with my family. We were up in Shasta and we always took a nightly cruise around when we did a houseboat trip up there. And I'm coming back and I see something like, I think do you guys know what a ball of fish is? Or anyhow, when fish get together, they'll ball and the top starts flapping around. And so I'm driving over there because I like to fish and I'm thinking, oh, this would be pretty cool. And about the time I realized that that is literally a mountain that is sticking out of the top of the water, and turn my engine off, my prop goes tink, tink, tink. I lost two blades on my prop and had one and a half. Now, do you know what cavitation is? So cavitation is when you don't have all your props to go forward, the engine goes boom, boom, boom. And that's how you move. You just, every time that makes a full rotation, you move. I was probably about 5 miles away from where our houseboat was parked. And we're moving along really, really slow. And I go, oh man, this isn't going to go well. And this is the bad part. My running lights weren't working either. So we're out on the water hoping and praying that nobody else is going to come flying across that thing at night and run into us. But I'm going, and I think I'm driving by the moonlight, and I'm doing the best I can. And all of a sudden, I ask one of the kids, I go, hey, somebody take a picture with your phone so I can see where I am. They took a picture. I was ready to run into a sandbar. That's how being at night isn't the greatest thing to drive. But some of these disciples that had gotten into this boat, do you think they were fishermen? They were fishermen. Some of them were fishermen. So navigating by night by them couldn't have been a problem. And it might have been that, hey, we just lined the boat up and over on the other side of the shore, there's always a light that burns, and so we'll just row to that. So they're on this, and I'm going to make this note, freshwater lake, and they're trying to get across the river, or trying to get across the lake. They get halfway across, and what happens? John? So if you...
It might have looked tranquil.
That's right.
When they set out, but then when they got a little ways in, about 4 or 5 miles in.
So I'm going to give you guys an observation that you would probably never pick up, and you'll get it now from this day forward. In Gualala, I can tell you if it's going to be a windy day. Without the news or nothing, I can go look at the ocean, and if I see white caps out on the ocean, I know it's going to be a windy day. What causes those white caps is the sun coming up. That's what causes the wind. And people will go, hey, we want to build a fire in the fire pit. And I go, once the sun goes down, the wind goes away. So there is a natural occurrence here that really doesn't happen. And that's why these fishermen wouldn't be too upset about, hey, all right, we'll get out of the boat and we'll start rowing. But this wind kicks up in the nighttime, and these guys are rowing, rowing, rowing. Has anybody ever rowed? If you've ever done it, you do it for about 5 minutes because you'll get huge blisters on your hands, and you just go, I quit. So here they're rowing and rowing and rowing. How long did they row? The Bible says anywhere between 7 to 9 hours. They're fighting this wind, and it's crashing over the top of the boat, and these guys are like, oh, we're... My question is, they're fighting a wind that's blowing right into their face. Why didn't they just turn around and go back to the other shore? Wouldn't that have been a whole lot easier? Kind of row with the wind? Yeah, you'd be pushed by the wind. Great example for us as Christians, that sometimes we have to fight against the wind because God has told us to do that. These disciples, God told them, or Jesus told them, you need to be over there. And they're fulfilling that command. They're doing it. They're rowing. They're trying to make this happen. So I don't know how many were in that boat, but the fact of the matter is, even if they all took turns, they got to be wore out, just absolutely beat that they fought this. Here's another interesting fact about the water. You put me on the salt water and on the sea, I'm seasick like that. You can put me in the roughest lake anywhere on the face of this earth and it won't bother me. Isn't that the most craziest thing? And I don't know if it's a salt air. I don't know if it's psychosomatic. I have no earthly idea. But I doubt that any of these guys are seasick, but it would have been a harrowing experience to be out there. And then who comes walking out? Okay. Yeah. How many of them were rowing and going, man, if Jesus would have only known this was going to happen to us. And then all of a sudden you look over, and one of the testaments says that Jesus is just kind of walking, and it's like he observes them. It's almost like he passes them up, and he just walks right past them. And he gets near the boat, and what do? They're in astonishment. They're in amazement. Well, here you are, and they take him in, and they put him in the boat, and what happens? What did you say, John? It's calm, but something else happens that they didn't have jet propulsion back then, but something else happened. What was it? They were at the other side, like that. So now, if the lake was how many furlongs or 3 or 4 miles they were in, the rest of the distance was 3 or 4 miles. So, Aaron, you're our mathematician. How fast do you think they were going to be able to get over there that fast? Well, I think it was fast enough to air dry every one of them. So their clothes were dry and their hair was dry and they were ready to go. And they were all set. But Jesus not only performed a miracle about walking on the water, he performed a miracle about calming the seas. And then, I think this is where Star Trek got that teleportation. They were teleported to that location. How many of you would think that was an experience that you could talk about at the kitchen table for a long, long time? How did he do that, Aaron?
Yeah. Because I want you to think about that. When you go to your corporate team events, why? Because all of these guys had all sorts of different backgrounds. They did not have anything in common. They still didn't know who this guy was.
Yeah.
They probably all didn't agree on who this guy was. As a matter of fact, there was only one person who spoke up. Peter spoke up. Does that mean that they were all in agreement? The Bible doesn't say it, but usually if they were, they would say, and they all nodded in agreement or something would happen.
Yeah. I love that.
He says, get in the boat.
I love that.
And it's like, okay, so he sets them out there by themselves, where they have to depend on each other.
Yeah. Aaron, that's a sermon topic for you. Yeah. Aaron, that's a sermon topic for you. Remember that one time? That's what it should be talked about. Yeah. 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 Okay, so this is the last thing I want to leave with you, and I'm sorry we didn't get very far. Maybe that's good that we didn't get very far. But here's the last thing I want to leave with you, is Jesus says this when he gets in the boat. He says, "It is I, be not afraid." How many times when you and I are in trouble that we just don't stop and listen and hear Jesus say, "I'm here, don't be afraid"? And this reminds me of what the Proverbs chapter 25:11 has to say. It said, "A word fitly spoken is like apples of gold and pictures of silver." Jesus spoke those comforting words to those disciples, and it had to be a harrowing experience. But I think the fascinating thing is that God has recorded this for us, that there are so many different learning lessons for it. Life is not promised to be easy. And sometimes we fight against the wind. And sometimes we don't have to fight against the wind. But I would say that the majority of our life is. And that would go back to what is said in Proverbs of travail. I can't get quoted exactly. But life is a travail, folks. But let's look for, and let's be able to hear those words. It is I, be not afraid. Hey, thank you very much for indulging me. I'm praying that Gil is better. If he's not, then we'll figure out what we can do next week as well. Thank you all. Appreciate your time.